when I was emailing Kristen about this yesterday, I'd been looking for some images, you know, to put on the sheet. In fact, if you look on the bottom here, there's Jesus and Muhammad, both with the book, Jesus with the scroll, Muhammad with the Quran, and then there's Jesus and Buddha. But in the process of looking for, you know, going through Google Images, I found this really funny one, which I will share with you. You know those jokes like a priest, a minister, and a rabbi go into a bar? Well, this is Muhammad, Buddha, and Jesus go into a bar. So you see them sitting on at the bar, and Muhammad is there with club soda because, you know, you know, faithful Muslims don't drink alcohol. And Muhammad's saying, it's awful. He said, they're out there killing people in my name. I never told them to do that. And Buddha, with his, you know, big stomach, you know, he's sitting there with tea, you know, tea ceremony, and he says, yeah, he says, I never told them to do that ethnic cleansing in Burma. And Jesus is there with a, you know, glass of red wine, and he said, yeah, try explaining the Inquisition and the Crusades. So it was a nice, kind of very friendly kind of a picture of, you know, three in a sense founders of religions. Not that any of them sought to found a religion. That's not something, you know, I mean, Jesus didn't come because he wanted to set up a religion. He came sent by the Father, you know, in this act of salvation and redemption, and you know, and as a result of that, you know, the church came into existence. And it's always interesting, I heard someone say once, the church does not have a mission. The mission has the church. And it's very good for us to remember that, you know, as Catholic Christians. We don't have a mission. The mission has us. Mm-hmm. Anyway, just by way of the purpose of this actually is to talk a little bit about the Monastic Interreligious Dialogue. It is a group of folks that are working to create connections between monastics of the West and monastics of Christian monasteries, both Benedictine and Trappist, because we all follow the rule of Benedict, and monastics of the East, primarily Buddhists, but there's also a greater interest now in also reaching out to Muslims because of all the issues, you know, regarding Muslims and all the misconceptions about Muslims. That there is a you know, great need to kind of reach out there too. So that's the purpose of the MID, the Monastic Interreligious Dialogue. I haven't gone to a meeting yet. We only have one meeting a year. Usually I think it's in October, so I can give you an update next year on when I go to the meeting. What kind of got me interested way, way long ago, it was one of those things that, one of those small details of life that became a real game changer and a life changer for me. I was in my second year of college. I had entered the monastery with my first year finished, and I went, you know, was back from my second year of college, and I had signed up for a course on Christology, the study of the theology of the Christ. The dean calls me in and says, there's really hardly anybody signed up for this course. He said, so you're going to have to pick something else that's got more of an enrollment. So I looked at the list and I thought, Eastern religions. I knew the teacher. I knew he was excellent. In fact, it was Abbot Leonard from Morristown. So I thought, yeah, I'll take Eastern religion. That should be kind of interesting. Well, it really became a life-changer course for me. That little moment in the dean's office when I had to pick a course, that has had a lasting impact on my life. And I always say when I was a novice, you know, early in my formation, that some of those ancient Eastern writers like Lao Tzu and of course Buddha were among my formation directors just as much as the real. In fact, my novice mistress used to. This is Sister Marlene, our resident Buddhist. You know. that has been just a lifelong interest. So when the opportunity came up to take part in this dialogue, you know, I just seemed like it was kind of, you know, something I really was excited about doing, and I'm very excited to be able to present this. You know, to you as well. So that's just my little introduction. We have here with us a video called Strangers No More. Now the whole thing runs almost an hour. I'd like us to watch, if it's okay with you, the first half hour of it, okay? Then we'll have some time to talk. And then after that, we can watch maybe just the tail end of it. I need to mention that there, because it's an international group and you're following different groups of monastics, East and West, throughout Germany and Italy and France and the Orient. There's a lot of what do you call it, subtitles, okay? So just so you're aware of that, you know, and I you know, I wish there was some way we could, like, you know, get it to translate all into English, auditorially, but.
The recommendation by the Buddhist monk that there shouldn't be reading at table.
Yes, isn't that interesting?
Yeah, so, and I immediately remembered the day Paul at one of our Paul what's Paul's name?
Who?
What?
Paul.
Oh, Paul.
Oh yeah. What's his
name? Tanda.
Huh?
Tanda.
Tanda. Paul Tanda.
No, no, but it comes to the Merton meetings.
Oh, Paul Schreiber.
Yeah. Yes. Okay. Oh. Remember, he had gotten the sack of White Castle's
sliders.
Oh, yeah.
And he suggested that we eat them mindfully, so we just ate them in silence. And then afterwards, we gave our reaction. And you know, the thing, it's interesting, the awareness that you have. You don't think about that, especially when you eat, that mind, being mindful.
They tasted
but I think,
better.
Yeah.
White Castle, they seem very, like, worldly.
Well, I think probably the introduction of reading during the meal may have something to do with the fact that eating is seen as kind of like worldly, fleshly, and so you must be distracted from the pleasure of eating.
Mm-hmm. Well, yes, and that Zen monk who looks like he's American, he maybe mentioned that the you know, in the West, we tend to see the body and soul as a split, and the soul is somehow better than the body, and the body is sort of to be just, you know, whipped into shape. And you see that in some of our spiritual traditions. I mean, almost frighteningly so. We read some of the stuff that, I mean, I remember reading about some saint who used to literally eat the mold off the wall to show how she loved Jesus. And I'm thinking, like, did Jesus ask you to do that?
Yeah.
You know. Whereas and so maybe that's why, as you say, maybe that's why we introduced table reading, because it was a way to get your mind off the material stuff. But in the Zen tradition, and that's the same thing with the tea ceremony. The purpose of it isn't to enjoy a cup of tea with a friend. The purpose of it is a mindful, you know, there's a ritual to it, and the Buddhist tea ceremony is to, you know, create a mindfulness of what you're doing. So yeah, in a way, reading could take away from the mindfulness.
Mm-hmm.
Now we normally have conversation during our meals, but certain days of the year, and certainly all during retreat, we have silence during meals, and it does make a difference. You tend to pay more attention to what you're doing, because there's no sound to distract you or to take you away from it. So it's all part of mindfulness training. And mindfulness is a concept that you find in all traditions, all deep spiritual traditions, whether it's Western Christian or Eastern Buddhist or Hindu or whatever. The notion of mindfulness, of being present in the now moment, the here and the now. Whatever that may be. There's no such thing as this is a holier moment than that. It's all holy, and we're always called to be in the now. And I think that's that's a great insight that, not, I mean, it doesn't just belong to the East. Western mystics, Christian mystics, have also seen that same insight, but it is something that's common to all those traditions. I would say about 25 years ago, you know, the Dalai Lama is sort of, if you want to have an equivalent, he would be sort of like the Buddhist Pope, you know. He wanted Buddhist monastics, nuns and monks, to learn how to support themselves by doing service. Because he felt that the monasteries were basically, in Buddhism, basically dependent upon donations, bequests, you know, people giving them money. Rather than doing something to earn money. And he believed that social service was very important, and that perhaps they could learn from Western monastics how we combine, you know, the contemplative life and also, you know, work that earns something and helps the monastery to keep itself going. So we had four, this is going back into the like late 1990s, we had four Buddhist monastics who came to visit us. The Dalai Lama sent them all over the place, and we happened to be one of the monasteries that they came to. Two monks, two nuns. One monk and nun were much older, and they had come through the Tibetan, the terrible massacres and purges that went on in Tibet of the Buddhists. So they had come through a horrific, you know, time in their own lives. Then there was a younger monk and nun, I think from India, and the four of them traveled together, and they wore the robes were like, they weren't the orange that you usually see, like a saffron color. It was more like a kind of a maroon kind of color, but they wore those. And they came to all our prayers, they came to Mass. We told them, you know, we have a Eucharistic holy hour, first Thursday of the month. They came to the Eucharist, made perfect sense to them. It was meditative, you know. And one day I said to, they loved ice cream, by the way. Loved ice cream. It was the first word they learned in our monastery, you know. But anyway, I said to the older monk, who had, he had the most beautiful face I think I've ever seen. Just such a face that, you know, had there been a lot of suffering in his life, but just a beautiful compassion. And I said to him, I noticed he wore beads. So I said, well, we have those too. I said, we call them rosaries. And he said, so do we. Okay. And it was interesting, a couple of the sisters took, we have a place down the Jersey Shore. So they took them down to show them the shore home, and it's right on the ocean. And it was very cold. And they really could not go out in those robes. It was just way too cold for that. So the two young ones wanted to go on the boardwalk. So they asked, they had to ask permission to wear, there were some black coats down in the house, if they could put those black coats on and walk down the boardwalk, because black for them, wearing black was a sign of, it's kind of a sign of wealth. And so the older monastics gave them permission to put on the black coats so that they could stay warm and walk up the boardwalk. I mean, it was just a fascinating experience. And one of the things, we had kind of a little orientation session before they came, and one of the things we were told is, don't try to like hug them in welcome or when they're leaving, because that's not their tradition. You know, they hugged us, which was really, it was just wonderful. It was just a wonderful experience, you know. But that this kind of initiative has been going on, you know, between, you know, monastics. And of course, although it's happening in monasteries, again, it has implications for all Christians and for all, you know, whether you're living in a, you know, you're a lay Christian or a lay Buddhist or Hindu or Muslim, that there is this this kind of openness. You know, the same God resides in all of us. There's you know, if a Muslim is sitting next to me, he doesn't have a different God living in him. I mean, it's all the same God, you know. And however we name that God, however we, you know, conceptualize about that God, speak about that God, God is one. And I think this kind of initiative is helping people to discover this. And when you read about deep meditation, you know, quiet prayer, not prayer that uses ideas or words, but just prayer that where you're simply sitting with God, the experience is very much the same. If you, you know, Buddhists talk about it, or you know, people who are in, say, a centering prayer group, it's very much the same. We have a centering prayer group that meets at our monastery first Saturday of the month, from like October to April, contemplative outreach, and we, you know, I usually try to join them, and we do a couple sessions of centering prayer. You know, that slow walking that they were doing, we do that. We kind of, if you choose, you just walk around the room, not that slow. Anybody that lives in the New York area can't walk that slow. But we walk very, and again, it's a mindfulness thing. It's like walking a labyrinth, if you've ever walked a labyrinth. It's that sense of mindfulness. First time I did it, I thought, okay, I'm going to do this, because everybody says you have to walk a labyrinth at some time in your life. This is really isn't going to make any sense. But when I started to do it, I became so mindful of walking of itself, not just as something I do to get to someplace, but simply as something to do. So a lot of those exercises help you to, I think, to see that everything we're doing exists in its own right. You know, I'm not, I can give you an example. When I was a novice, somebody gave us this big bale of corn, you know, in the, you know, still in the husks. So a couple of the younger sisters and Sister Zita, who was much older and wiser, we were asked if we would go and pull the husks off the corn. So, you know, we're all sitting there, you know, looking at our watch. And Sister Zita is, you know, every little piece of silk. She's from Germany, so she, you know, she was a cook for a long time. So, and what sister, one of the sisters next to me said, you know what, we're doing this to get it done. She's doing it to do it. And I go, yeah, that's the contemplative, you know, whatever we're doing, washing dishes, grading papers, riding a bus, walking. I mean, how many times is my brain a million miles away when I'm walking, you know? Or driving, which, well, that's scary. You know? So there really is that need to be mindful and to look at each moment as somehow, you know, the most important moment there is, because it is. It's all we have is now, you know, and the minute we think about it, it's already over and we're in a new now. And God exists in now. God does not exist in time. God doesn't have past and future. He just has an eternal present. So when we're mindful, we're actually in God's word, you know. Anyway, let's hear from you.
What comes to mind, so American, the to-do list.
Oh, yeah.
And like, I sometimes feel like you just get check this off your list.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that's such a concept for us.
Yeah, got mine right in my bag. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah.
Is it true? Yeah. And I mean, you know, there's a saying in I think it's in the Tao Te Ching, you know, do what needs to be done. I mean, you do have to do stuff, you know, we have to do stuff, but we do it because it needs to be done, but we don't make it a, you know, zooming through one thing to get to the next thing,
Like
thing.
Sure,
you know,
sometimes, yeah.
Yeah, and then at the end of the day, you say, well, you know, I got all those things done, and if I had done them faster, I could have gotten this done, too.
Yeah.
Like, you know, where are we going?
Yeah.
Where are we going?
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
I think it's interesting that in the Gospel of Luke, with that Greek, he's talking to the Greek people, and Eugene Leverrier was saying he's got all these meals set up, and because, well, it's not unlike us today. We don't invite another couple over. Let's come over and talk.
Yeah.
Would you like to come over for dinner?
Mm-hmm.
Like to go out for breakfast? Now, that is not an invitation to go out and get enough nourishment to make it through the day. That's an invitation to have a conversation.
Yes.
Which ultimately is about what? Sharing yourself and trying to find out what these other people are about.
Correct.
That's
yes.
A lot.
Yeah. And it's true. So there's a book, I forget who wrote it, but it's called Eating Your Way Through the Gospel of Luke.
Oh, I like that.
Because
because
Jesus, and Luke really uses the meal as the vehicle.
I think it might be Leverdier's book, but I'm not sure. But he had one out along that same line.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this one is a Leverdier. I forget. I think it's a Franciscan. But yeah, Leverdier did a lot of work on that. Yeah, and it is very, a meal is not just, you know, to stuff ourselves, but you know, we invite people. And Jesus left us, you know, the memorial of his sacrifice in a meal. You know, the most basic substances of bread and wine, kind of, they're universal. So,
I'm going to put Terry on the spot because he's probably one of the few people. Maybe you can share your experience when you were in Asia with being with monks.
I'm a very, very peaceful.
When he was
very, the mindset, mm-hmm. very focused.
Mm-hmm.
Like I said, when you're walking, you're doing an act of the walking. You're not focused on what you're really actually feeling when you're walking, of whatever you're walking on actually transcends to your mm-hmm. to your senses.
Yeah.
And it's different if you just let go and just walk and kind of like with Native Americans. I'm part Native American, where we're in connection with Mother Earth. When we walk to the ground and we do our ceremonial
mm-hmm.
Spiritual dances, we're mm-hmm. in connection, and the drum is a heartbeat of the earth, of the whole sense. And we stay in rhythm with the drum. The same thing with the Orientals. I was over in Asia, and I met some people, and they were had trained in some of the arts of martial arts, the samurai training, and they were always saying to us, one mind, because you would be distracted by everything around you when you're in dark places. They said, if you really want to conquer and be good at what you're doing, you have to be of one mind. Just totally put your mind on your opponent and think of nothing else. Mm-hmm. And you can actually feel and sense what they're going to do.
Yeah, you mentioned that, the word focus, and I think mm-hmm. that really sums it up. Yeah,
right.
Yes, absolutely. And the walking, too. I mean sometimes, I like to take a walk on the monastery grounds, but of course, as I'm walking, I'm thinking, okay, let's see, when I get back inside, vacuum, yeah. and I get to the office and see if I can finish the payroll, and then I'll finish up the liturgy for next week, yeah. you know, just walk. And, yeah. you know, and in the process, of course, you know, you notice what's around you, which is also a form of mindfulness, you know.
Right. How did you come to meet the monks over there? I forget.
There were, and unfortunately, there weren't a lot of priests, a lot of religious, military religious, you know, we didn't have that much access to them.
Right.
They were more Buddhist monks, and I noticed that a lot of the other fellows that were over there serving started to connect with the Buddhist monks because it helped us and them to go out in the field and be totally a mindset of what's going on mm-hmm. and not distracted. Mm-hmm. And also, we felt the deep sense of their spiritual aspect. We treated things and acted differently mm-hmm. when we went to,
yeah.
to pray with them and blessed by them,
mm-hmm.
even though we're going to combat.
And I think, you know, when you think about the culture that we're living in right now, which it does everything to militate against mindfulness. I mean, I was up at the Abbey in Morristown for a Jubilee a couple of weeks ago. Now, these are kids, they're teenagers, so I mean, you have to allow for that. But I guess they were four grandnieces or whatever of the monk who was having his Jubilee. And they were all walking together, like two and two, you know, their little bags over one shoulder. And each one in the left hand had her cell. I mean, it was like, they were like in parade formation. And it was almost like, okay, right hand with your bag, left hand with your cell phone. And you're looking, I'm thinking to myself, like, what are we raising here, you know? But it's, I mean, you hear about the horrible mishaps people have because they're texting mm-hmm. while they're walking, or texting and get hit by a car. But even aside from those kind of egregious dangers, just what is it doing to our sense of presence to the moment?
Yes.
You know, if we have to be constantly, in touch, available, and I mean, it's good to be available. Nothing wrong with that. Jesus was certainly available. But that sense that there's always something else out there that has to impinge all the time, and because it's possible to do it with our technology, does that mean we should do it?
Right.
You know, I mean, or are there times when we just need to unplug? They did studies of people, wired them up, all their vitals, put a cell phone in front of them, but told them they weren't to touch the cell phone. And then someone from another room would call that cell, and they said, people's vitals went crazy because we are so, our whole body, our bodies are getting so inured to having to respond all the time and grab it and text it and respond. And people will say to you, I called you on your cell phone. I had it turned off. Sorry. So that's, yeah. And anyone else?
Yeah.
Anthony.
I want to ask, this Buddha is just like Christianity, Catholic Church. The Catholic Church has a Catholic Church, and they have a monk different from the church.
Mm-hmm.
Is it the same with the Buddha? Buddha monk and Buddha church.
Many of the Buddhist monks often just go in for a time, and they train in meditation, they train in mindfulness, then they go back out. So many of them only, they're in the monastery for maybe a few years. However, there is permanent commitment. There's a village in France called Plum Village, and it's a Zen Buddhist community. And I looked up their website, and there were pictures of like kind of permanent profession ceremonies, just as we have solemn profession here. They have a permanent life profession for their monks. So there is some permanently vowed monks and nuns, but not to the extent that we have it in church.
Do they have Buddhist monks in monasteries?
I'm sorry?
Do they have Buddha nuns?
And nuns, yes.
Yeah, nuns, just
yeah.
like we do.
There's a monastery up in Mount Tremper, New York. I visited it years ago. I was the one who came, person who came to the door was a woman named Denise Murphy, who was a Buddhist monk. And she had a shaven head and she wore saffron robes and she took us on a little tour. So yeah, there are Buddhist monasteries in our own country. In fact, monastic interreligious dialogue next year, I think our meeting is supposed to be at a Zen monastery in California. So I'm very excited about that. Yeah.
Now both the women and the men shaved their heads?
Yes,
okay.
They do.
Okay. Yeah. I wasn't sure if that was the woman.
Yeah, some of those were women that were speaking.
Okay,
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
This Buddha is in India, is it?
Buddha was actually Indian. The original, the person, Gautama Buddha, was Indian.
Is it affiliated with Hinduism?
But we tend to associate Buddhism more with China. Mm-hmm. And Japan, you know, and we tend to associate Hinduism with India, but in fact, a Buddha was actually, and the story about it was that he was a young prince who was shielded from everything. He was not allowed, permitted to see anything bad, any sickness, any death, any disease, and at some point he was out and he saw, you know, a sick man, a corpse, and then he had to try to make sense of all that, and he sat under a tree for a long time. And it finally, he realized that the cause of most of our problems is desire, and therefore to be desireless, and in a good sense of the word, was actually part of the spiritual journey. And he had this enlightenment. It's called the Enlightenment of the Buddha on December the 8th, Immaculate Conception. You know, so it's kind of interesting. And we celebrate Mary's Immaculate Conception. Buddhists are celebrating the enlightenment of their spiritual leader. Anyone else?
Well, I was thinking what he was asking is, I think he was parallel. We have monks, and we have lay people. Are they the equivalent of Buddhist lay people? I think he was asking.
If you're not
in a monastery, can you be a Buddhist? No.
Wait, what you mean?
Are there people that are Buddhists that aren't monks?
Oh, absolutely, yes, okay. Yes. In fact, there are two different like kind of divisions of Buddhism, and the Hinayana is those that are in monasteries and lead a more, you know, kind of rigorously ascetic life. And then you have the Mahayana Buddhism, which is kind of the Buddhism for most people. So yes, there are definitely, yes.
Thank you.
Yeah, not all Buddhists are monks and nuns. I'm sorry, I misunderstood your question.
I thought it was interesting that if these children were found the detour that they did.
Oh, in Thailand, yes.
That one of the comments that somebody made was that when they get out of the hospital, they are going to spend 10 days in this monastery.
Really?
I didn't hear anything you said.
Alice said that the children that were finally rescued from the cave in Thailand, once they're out of the hospital, they will spend 10 days?
10 days, I think they said.
In a Buddhist monastery. Well, you know, their leader, their coach or whatever he was, he had been in a monastery. And while they were down there, some of the newscasts said that he taught them meditation in order to help them to stay centered and focused and more peaceful, to kind of get them centered. You know, so, and he may have been a Buddhist who, you know, went into a monastery for a period of time, took his training, and then came back out. So he's actually doing exactly what that's supposed to accomplish. He helped other people through the training that he had, you know. And today, you know, we have people who, I mean, we always want to have people who come and enter and stay permanently, but we also have people who come to the monastery, as yourselves, as oblates, or who come and spend perhaps, like we have what we call a monastic residency, where people come and live with us for a period of time, live the life, do the work, and then, you know, go back out and hopefully take it out to wherever they live, you know. So, I want to just point a couple of things out on the green sheet on the bottom. Oh, sorry. You get two, actually. Anybody else need one? On the bottom there, a couple of things, it says, and this was somewhere in the film, to think differently about what is mine. We can learn about our own tradition through the eyes and the optics of other traditions. I mean, I think that's why it was such so valuable to me when I was early in formation. Stuff that was making no sense to me, and I was like battling with, you know, personally, just because I was young and headstrong. And I couldn't see it if you explained it from a Christian perspective. I don't know, that's old stuff. But then I heard it from an Asian perspective, from a Taoist and Buddhist and Hindu. And because it was different, it helped me to understand, and then I saw it. So sometimes it helps us to understand more deeply what is our own tradition when we hear the same things expressed in different languages. It kind of brings us up short, you know, and it's not just the same old stuff. And the other thing that they quoted in this, I think it was Father William Scholarik, that to recognize, preserve, and promote the socio-cultural and spiritual values of other traditions from Vatican II, not just to tolerate, not just to say, well, you know, those people can, you know, God accepts them and loves them, and, you know, God will somehow. No, you know, like to actually, to see the value of these other traditions. Now, and finally, there's something, one of the people in the film says, we go from fidelity to fidelity. We don't stop being faithful to our own tradition, but we learn the fidelity of other traditions, and it enriches our own. Now, I looked some of these things up. I just Googled, recognize, preserve, and promote, you know, non-Christian religions, and I Googled, and I got these horrific arch-conservative websites came up, you know, about how, you know, and one of them, there are some Catholics in the church, there are some groups that actually believe that we haven't had a valid pope, I guess, since Pius XII, maybe, because once Vatican II started, it invalidated everything. And so therefore, and they're talking about how we're taking these pagan, false religions, how can we promote something that's pagan and false, and, you know, and it's so contrary to what the church sees today. And John Paul II, who certainly was doctrinally very, you know, very orthodox, but he was one of the people who really helped to promote this. And our own Pope also, you know, was encouraging, particularly Benedictines and oblates by association, to you know, to be hospitable and to open doors to people of other traditions, because we can learn so much from them, you know. Anyway, anything else?
I just find that I end up in places by myself a lot, and like a lot of times it's a bar, and I'm reading a book, and somebody's like, "What are you reading?" I'm like, "Oh boy, how do you explain Thomas Merton?" Well, and then we get into like the whole church talk and the whole thing. Mm-hmm. But I find for myself, with having to explain it to somebody else, it reinforces or reminds me of what's going on, or, you know, they'll ask me questions that I'll be like, I never thought of that before. Let me come up with something. So it you know, when you're talking about from the to think differently about what's mine, you know, like people, you know, random people make me do that. I can go through my everyday life and not think of that ever, and then randomly out, somebody goes, "What are you reading?" It's like, oh boy, you know, it's a 2-hour-long discussion.
Yes.
So
yes.
It ends up very strange, but I always appreciate those things. You know, that it really. You know, it wakes up my mind again.
Absolutely.
Me out of that rut. You know?
Yeah, I know, and watching this, it's really refreshed me every time I watch it, you know. And of course, I mean, everybody here knows Thomas Merton, right? Some of us really know Thomas Merton really well. But, you know, he really helped to engender this. He had he was fascinated by Gandhi as a young man. Wrote, wrote a paper on Gandhi. And then when he was at Columbia, if you have not read Thomas Merton's autobiography, even though it's dated in some way, you have to read it. When he's at Columbia and he sort of stumbles upon this Hindu monk named Brahmachari, who kind of, he had the people always tell me I have weird friends, and sisters always say to me, "Ken, you have the strangest friends. You're just Thomas Merton's friends." But, you know, he learned a lot, and he was so fascinated by this Hindu monk, and he said to him, you know, "What should I do?" And the monk said to him, "Go into your own tradition. Go into your own tradition." And at that point, he was becoming a Catholic, or had become a Catholic. So, you know, but Merton did a lot to further and initiate this dialogue very early on, before Vatican II. You know, he was already reading the Asian mystics. So it's pretty much right in the tradition.